Hello, I'm Greg Johnston. Welcome to Imagining the Past, the 2023 season. HNSA acknowledges the traditional custodians of the land on which we work and live, and recognises their continuing connection to the land, water, and community. We pay respects to elders past, present, and emerging. The Historical Novel Society Australasia promotes the reading, writing and publishing of historical fiction through our biennial conferences and online programs. The ARA Historical Novel Prize is now the richest genre-based literary award in Australasia, a breathtaking $100,000 divided between the adult and CYA categories. Robin Mundy is the author of three novels, The Nature of Ice, Wild Light, and her latest, Cold Coast. The novels are inspired by her love of wild and chilly places. For over 20 years, Robin has worked seasonally as a ship-based tour guide in Svalbard, Greenland, Antarctica, the Norwegian coast, and wild Scotland. Her numerous visits to Svalbard led to her 2021 novel, Cold Coast. It's my pleasure to give Robin a warm welcome to Imagining the Past and a warming chat.
Thank you, Greg. It's great to be here.
I always start my interviews with just asking people what was the first time they thought they might become a writer.
You know, it's a great question, and I'd love to say, oh, I've been writing since I was 5 years old, but the truth is, though I have been writing since I was 5 years old, I didn't imagine myself as a writer probably until my mid-30s when I first went to university. And I was working as a graphic designer at the time, and I just decided on this radical change of career that I was going to become a speech pathologist. And I did a year of speech and, you know, did okay in it, but I realized that I wasn't interested at all in the kind of science or diagnostic aspects of speech. What I was interested in were the stories that people, how it is for people in the world to have, say, a voice disorder. And so I thought, well, what am I going to do now? You know, I don't want to keep doing speech. And so I thought, well, I may as well do arts. And that was when I really first seriously started writing, you know, short stories for assignments and just starting to get a sense like, oh, this touches me in a way I didn't expect.
What were your first thoughts about Cold Coast? How did that kind of start to come together?
Well, writing is a passion for me, but it's one passion. And the other part of my life is that I'm a ship-based polar tourism guide. And I've been doing that for more than 20 years in both the Antarctic and the Arctic. And each northern summer, we regularly travel up to Svalbard, which is an archipelago owned by Norway, way north of Norway, way north of the Arctic Circle. And probably my first or second season there, we went into a fjord in the southwest corner of the main island of Spitsbergen. And it was a beautiful fjord. And there was this pint-sized trapper's cabin at the end there. And it was sitting at the base of this huge mountain that was just filled with seabirds and shrieks and cries. And I remember actually seeing a glimpse of an Arctic fox patrolling the bird cliffs. And then I learned that cabin was had previously been a trapper's cabin used for trapping foxes. And it was used by a woman called Vonnie Voldstad in the early 1930s, and that she was the first woman trapper to work in Svalbard at a time when it was a totally male domain. And that just utterly piqued my interest. That, and you'll know it, Greg, you know that moment when you feel something tingle inside you and you think, oh, I've got to follow this. I don't know where it's going to lead, but that's how it began.
And down the foxhole in your case, you go with the research. So, well, I'm glad you've orientated, because I was going to ask you, you know, a short geography lesson about where the novel was set, because to be honest, anything north of the Italian peninsula leaves me a bit cold. So, so all of your novels, The Nature of Ice, Wild Light, and now Cold Coast, they're all set in cold climates. And I'm just wondering about this kind of interest you have with cold climates, and how did that start? I mean, you know, I don't think Launceston was that cold.
It's a good question. I mean, what listeners may not know is that you and I spend our growing up together on a beautiful peninsula called the Freycinet Peninsula on the east coast of Tasmania, which is not known for cold weather. It's actually considered by Tasmanian standards to be quite balmy. But I became intrigued with Antarctic history, with the photography of Frank Hurley, the story of the Australian explorer Douglas Mawson. And in my very earliest memories of the Freycinet Peninsula, we were, you know, in a shack that had no power, but Dad would turn on the transistor radio to listen to the ABC News, and there'd always be a weather report from Matsaka Island, which is this wild and woolly, windswept island off the southwest corner of Tasmania, and it's home to Australia's southernmost lighthouse. And I used to have imaginings of these, you know, lighthouse keepers trudging to the lighthouse in a huge gale. And I think those were the seeds of one, wanting to go to those places, and then wanting to write about them.
I think I was going to ask you about that later, about Tasmania, but I mean, the names of places on the east coast of Tasmania for me were always incredibly evocative, because they, you know, the word Freycinet is, you know, not really an English word. Bruny Island and Don Tricasco, there were always these amazingly kind of colourful names which kind of populated my imagination.
Yeah, for sure.
So with this novel, and I think the other two novels as well, you've always kind of written in present tense. I'm just kind of wondering what your path is into that, and what you kind of think that does for a piece of writing.
Do you know, I hadn't even realised that, Greg, but I know, I remember, are you sure about that? They're all present tense.
Well, I might be wrong, but I think Wildlight is, isn't it? And I thought The Nature of Ice was. I should have found my copy, sorry.
No, I think you might be right. And I do recall writing, you know, when you, in the early stages of writing Cold Coast, or maybe it was Wildlight, trying past tense, and always, it, for some reason, it didn't sit with me. And perhaps it's that sense of immediacy that present tense brings. It's like for a writer or a reader, the events are playing out at this, almost at the same time as the writing is being written down on the page. And maybe that sense of immediacy is something that just inherently connects with me, but I really don't have a good reason. And with my next novel, I'm going to really interrogate myself about present and past tense.
Because you've also written with Cold Coast, it's in third person, which does kind of, I always kind of think a third person narrative kind of implies there's someone after the event. You know, there's this kind of person who's looking down on this and recounting this story in a very kind of traditional manner, I guess. So I'm just wondering, I mean, you talk about the intimacy and the immediacy of present tense. I'm just kind of wondering what other kind of colours a writer has on their palette to kind of create those kinds of things. Because, I mean, I find present tense is often overused.
Yeah. Well, maybe going back to the fact that the stories are in third person, I might look at a different angle on that and say that With third person, a writer has the freedom to stay at a distance and, as you say, almost an omniscient viewpoint of the characters. But they also have the ability to hone in almost like a zoom lens and to be inside the character's head. Even though the writing is told in third person, it has the ability to function as first person, as if your character is seeing the world from their eyes and their thoughts and feelings. So I really love that ability to zoom in and zoom out with third person. And I have tried first person, and hopefully I'll try it again, but for me, the third person really offers the greatest flexibility. Well, one of the challenges of first person is that the character can only know the world through their own limits. And so it's an extra challenge to show things that the character themselves doesn't know.
Yeah, but it also serves you if you're writing, as an extreme example, a mystery or a thriller, then your character, if you're in first person, can only see what's around them. So the mystery has to unfold to them, and it has to unfold to the reader as well. So
yeah, you're absolutely right. Yeah, and that must just add so much narrative tension.
And I just think it's a point often writers, when they commence writing, they don't play out all these options and then work out which is the best one for the story I want to tell.
Yeah.
So it's a lot of kind of experimentation. You've also used a lot of point of views, like you do shift around between, is it Vonnie and Anders? Is that the
Yep, right? That's the exact pronunciation. And also, yeah, some...
And into the animals as well. So I'm just wondering, in your planning, how you decided to do those kinds, to shift the points of view. And
yeah, I always wanted to have the human narrative be, excuse me, both from Vonnie's point of view and her trapping partner Anders' point of view. I wanted that kind of male and female point of view to be available to me. And then there are interleaved between the human chapters are chapters predominantly told from the perspective of an Arctic fox. And I really wanted a counterpoint to the human story, both because that little fox is both a hunter itself and hunted. And the big challenge with telling a story from an animal's perspective is anthropomorphism. And at all costs, I wanted to avoid that. So if someone is studying those chapters, there's next to nothing in there about the animal's feelings. It's all about its actions. But still, hopefully, through those actions, our readers might feel a relationship with the animal and hopefully a sense of warmth toward that little fox. And then, exactly as you say, there are, I think, three chapters, one couple from a polar bear perspective and one from guillemot, which is a seabird perspective. So for me, I wanted to show the animal world and to give that the space it commands in the Arctic.
So what kind of research did you do to frame up the animals? How did you approach becoming them?
I did a huge amount of research on the history side of it and the trapping side of it. With the fox and the animals, as I said, I've been working as a polar guide now for over 20 years, and a lot of it is just knowledge that I've accumulated through my own, personal experiences with foxes and with bears in the Arctic, but also, reading field guides and talking with other experts and hearing other people's stories about their encounters with foxes and bears. So it was a combination of those things.
I'm just wondering too about the process of the writing. Did you write the human stories, for want of a better word, and then the animal stories, and then bring them together? Or did you actually write them as they were unfolding? And what were the, I mean, dangers is not the right word, but were there problems of bringing these two stories into such close contact?
No, I wrote it exactly as it appears in the published novel. I might have switched around a couple of chapters, but generally I would write a fox chapter, write a human chapter, and so on. What I'd sort of disciplined myself to do was to ensure that those animal chapters were very succinct, quite short, so that there was that just a kind of taking a breath between the larger human chapters.
It's an incredibly enclosed world you've written about, you know, like it's essentially two human characters in a couple of different huts. So that must have posed you a lot of challenges to keep that alive and active and moving with such a small cast and scenes.
Yes, it's true. That's true, isn't it? And, you know, I do admire other authors who can sort of pull that off with just a solitary character in a novel. You know, Anders and Vonnie do kind of bounce off one another, and so the dialogue was quite important in terms of, you know, dialogue is a fast-paced aspect of reading and writing. So that was an important element. And then their actual adventures, you know, there's quite a bit of drama in there, and it's true to Vonnie's diaries of the kind of mishaps and close calls that happen to them. And then just the sort of meditative aspect of how they as characters connected with this landscape, and how for Vonnie it offered a space for her to reflect on the things that she was less than happy with about her life back in Norway.
Yeah, I mean, you did an amazing job of it, I think, but it is quite a challenge. It reminded me, I don't know if you've ever seen a film, it was out in the 70s called My Dinner with Andre, which was just about these two men having dinner. So it was shot in one shot in a restaurant. They're just sitting eating. So on one level, it's incredibly enclosed, but because their conversation and their dialogue is so alive, you sit there for an hour and a half or 2 hours. So what was, I mean, you've kind of touched on this, was the gestation period for the novel sounds like it was quite long. You know, had the idea, and then it took you quite a while to get to write it. What was the delay, and, you know, what kind of things happened in your imagination during that time? Because, you know, that's the period where a novel's kind of born.
The initial delay was sheer terror. You know, what I thought of for myself as the audacity of writing about a real person, not even from my own country or culture or language, and just it seeming too daunting and, as I said, audacious to even contemplate that. But it kept niggling at me, and once I'd finished Wildlight and was thinking about what I was going to write, you know, I just did a bit of reading and a little bit more research. And every time I would go to Tromsø, which is a town in northern Norway where Vonnie spent her younger years, I'd go to the Polar Museum there and go to the local beer hall where she, as a young female taxi driver, would ferry the trappers to and from the pub. And eventually I just summoned somehow the courage to go, I'm going to go for it, you know, and I'm going to go for it. So the actual thinking about it, yes, it took ages, took years. And then the research itself, which comprised actually, you know, a wonderful grant from the Australia Council, and being able to go to Tromsø and spend a couple of weeks there, and getting hold of Bonnie's diary, which was written in Norwegian through a document delivery service at the library, and getting that translated. Once I'd kind of accumulated a body of research, I felt more confident about feeling authorized, maybe that's the wrong word, but to be able to write this story.
It's a bind, isn't it? Because you want the character to sit on your shoulder, but at the same time, you need to brush them off your shoulder because you have to, you know, make your own mark about what their life was. So it's quite
yeah, that's
a bind.
Right. That's exactly right. I think, you know, you don't want the research to be there on top of the page. It's another writer years ago described it to me as like a half forgotten, the research should become a half forgotten dream where it's kind of there in your subconscious, but it doesn't sit on top of the page.
Yeah, it leads nicely into the next thing I wanted to discuss, which was you have a PhD in creative writing, and I'm just wondering how that doing that thing, doing a PhD, how that informed your writing. And, you know, it obviously must have helped you getting good research habits and interpretations and things. But I just wonder how the discipline of academic writing, which is quite different to creative writing, impacted on your creative writing, or if you feel it did.
Yeah, the PhD, when you do a PhD in creative writing, you're expected to produce a creative work, a substantial creative work, such as a novel or a collection of poetry or whatever. And for that to be bolstered by what's called an exegesis or an academic essay, which has informed your research and whose research informs your creative work. And I think for a lot of writers, including myself, you know, the exegesis is by far the hardest thing to tackle. You know, I'd much rather write write fiction than academic writing. And, you know, it's something that I really had to work hard at and needed a lot of mentoring, and I had a wonderful mentor. And probably having a mentor for both parts of the PhD, but most especially for the creative work. I had a wonderful man, Richard Rossiter, who lives in Western Australia and is still a great friend. That just was such a gift to be able to have pretty, you know, sometimes harrowing feedback, but to have this wonderful support of a supervisor slash mentor. So I think that was the greatest asset of the PhD, along with, as you mentioned, creating a discipline around writing that, you know, you're not just writing when you're feeling inspired. You choose to do what you want in terms of the hours you put in, but it's either a part-time job or a full-time job.
I'm just wondering, though, the difference between writing academic prose and writing creative. I mean, to me, they're not poles apart, but they are quite different. You know, one's an academic writing is trying to assert something as a fact, whereas a creative writing is trying to just open up the metaphor and allow the reader to, you know, construct the meaning. So did you find that those two styles of writing kind of impacted on one another, or did you feel comfortable moving from one to the other?
I wrote the first draft of the novel first, and then I tackled the exegesis. And what I did find after writing the exegesis, that I went back and added things to the novel or edited things, because I'd gained some new perspectives and new knowledge. But in terms of your fundamental question, the different styles of writing, yes. For me, it was not a natural fit. It was a real challenge, and I had to just work very hard to kind of create an academic identity and to write in a particular way that is deemed credible by a university.
You've mentioned the diary, what Vonnie's diary. I'm just wondering about what it was like to find that. Is that kind of freely available, or did you have to really kind of search around to find it? And And what kind of other moments in the research, because that must have been quite phenomenal to have that. And you know, you got it, obviously had to get it translated. How was that doing, getting that organized and things?
Yeah, so Bonnie had her memoir published in 1956, I think it was, and it was published in Oslo. And I'd seen a copy of it in the Polar Museum in Tromsø. And of course, you know, there's a secondhand bookstore in Tromsø, and I went to see if there was a copy, and they said, oh no, you know, they're as rare as hen's teeth. But I came back to Tassie, and the university library here have a really wonderful document delivery service, as do many libraries. And they were able to, well, I was able to track down that there was a copy of this book in a library in Wisconsin in the USA. So it actually took nearly 6 months to get a copy of that through the document delivery service. And then I just happened to know a woman whose mother's Norwegian and whose father's English, and she agreed to do the translation on condition that it wouldn't be considered a formal translation. But she also worked very closely with her mother, who was living in Oslo, over things that she, you know, maybe references, historical references, or particular terms that she wasn't totally clear on. So her mum also had a great contribution. And just having that diary translated into English, it was both really, it formed the structure of the novel, but it was both exciting and exhilarating, but also frustrating because Vonnie painted a really fantastic picture of day-to-day life as a trapper and in the hut, and combining all the domestic duties with then going out with a rifle and setting traps and so on. But there's only really a few moments in that diary where she shares her internal world and her deepest thoughts. And I just held on to those little snippets, and I just craved to have had more of them. So in that way, yeah, you know, she was a woman of her time in the way she wrote her memoir.
Yeah, it must have been very exciting to find that and have that. So you must have had to make a lot of decisions about how to represent their language, particularly their speech acts, because you're writing in English to a modern reader. So what kind of process did you go through with that in, you know, making those decisions about how you would represent their language?
The novel does have quite a few Norwegian words in it, and they're italicized, and I did include a glossary at the end of the novel. And I felt that added an element to the novel in just being able to make reference to the language. Then, of course, once I had it written, I also kind of ran it by a Norwegian speaker to make sure that my use of that language was done correctly.
But things like I'm thinking the characters don't use contractions very much. Like it's, you know, I am or I did not, rather. So were they conscious decisions you made to kind of like it gives their language a kind of formality?
Yes, it does. And they were conscious decisions. And I think that was coloured by the amount of archival reading that I did, and even having those Norwegian documents and newspaper interviews with Bonnie had been translated into English, and getting a sense of the language. And that combined with, you know, for probably 3 years, all I read in terms of my own fiction was nor were Norwegian novels or Scandinavian novels that had been translated into English, and partly to learn more about the culture and the kind of feel of the Norwegian culture, but also to get a sense of, a collective voice. And that certainly influenced how I wrote. I had to put away all my own Aussie contractions and really, really immerse myself in a different kind of voice.
Oh, well, fortunately, no one says g'day. So I'm just wondering, you've kind of touched on this, but I'm just wondering about what kind of impact growing up in Tasmania had on your writing, but also just what kind of impact did music have that you were listening to when you were growing up? What kind of impact did that have on you?
Absolutely, nature had a massive impact, and it continues to do so in all my writing. All my novels are set in wild places, and nature almost operates as a character in the book. In terms of music, Greg, as you well know, I'd be listening to Simon and Garfunkel, and I can't remember, Cat Stevens, and a whole bunch of those, that ilk of musicians. So I should ask you the same question. Who were you listening to?
Well, I was listening to David Cassidy and the Partridge Family, but fortunately I grew up from that. But I do think, like, I mean, it was my discovery of Joni Mitchell that really changed the way I looked at music, but it also changed the way I looked at just what you could do with language, because her language is so alive, and someone like Paul Simon, his lyrics are the same.
Yes.
They're just alive. So you were shortlisted for the ARA Historical Novel Prize. I'm just wondering what that meant to you, like on a personal level, but also just generally, what do you think the role of these kind of literary prizes are?
The ARA Historical Novel Prize was just the most fantastic opportunity. I think, am I right that it's kind of one of the only historical novel competitions that there is, and it's got a really hefty prize pool and a great lot of cachet that comes with it. And to be longlisted was absolutely thrilling. And I thought, well, I've been longlisted, and that's as good as it gets. And then to be shortlisted alongside Thomas Keneally and Geraldine Brooks was, look, I really felt like I'd been seated at the table alongside literary royalty. And it's really a highlight of my writing career. And what does it mean to me? Well, of course, it was fantastic to win a little purse of money, which always helps any writer. But just as important was that kind of validation, affirmation that what you're doing is worth something. And I just think these kind of opportunities for writers are extraordinary. And that this prize is available within Australasia, it's open to Australia and New Zealand, I think has and will make a lot of difference to a lot of writers' lives, and also alert readers as to how much fantastic historical fiction there is, both in adult literature and young readers and children's literature.
Yeah, I think that's true, that the winners of these competitions is one thing, but the long lists are I always kind of feel like with the Booker, often the long lists are actually more interesting than the ones that win, really, a lot of the time. So what are you working on now? What have you started on?
Well, I mentioned that I'm a polar tourism guide, and I went to the New Zealand subantarctics on a ship in November and December, and I just happened upon this historical story, and it made me tingle. And usually that's a sign that maybe I need to kind of follow that up. So I'm just in the process, baby steps really, of just doing some research into that story. I don't know where it'll lead, but I'm hoping that will lead to the next novel, and once again is set in a cold place, desolate place, but a most extraordinarily beautiful place. The New Zealand subantarctics are just gold. So we'll see.
Well, that leads into my next question. I'm just wondering if we'll ever traverse the Simpson Desert with you.
I don't know. The idea sounds totally appealing. I don't know how I'd go in the heat.
Well, I'd just be interested because, you know, the whole process of writing a novel is so long and so complicated, and so many other voices, other people weigh into it. But I'm just wondering, what was the first scene you wrote for Cold Coast, and did it actually survive into the novel?
The first scene I wrote was the second chapter, which is set at the local beer hall in Tromsø, and it's told from Anders Sætherdal. He's the second character, the male trapper who was Vonnie's trapping partner, told from his point of view, where, you know, he's had a few too many beers, he's looking for a trapping partner, he's desperate. And it's the scene where, when he comes out of that pub, he sees Vonnie sitting on the bonnet of her taxi, and she was Tromsø's very first female taxi driver in 1932. And yes, that chapter did remain, but is now preceded by a very short opening chapter told from an Arctic fox's point of view.
Oh, that's lovely. It's nice to know how, you know, the cards were shuffled and how it was put together. So, yeah, lovely. Well, that's, I think, our conversation for today. I've really enjoyed it. It was nice to hear your machinations.
Greg, I really appreciate how closely you've engaged with the novel and the time you've put into the questions and the conversation. It's really been a delight. Thank you.
All right. Thanks a lot for your time.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to Imagining the Past, the 2023 season. Please remember to step back in time to our podcast archive, where you'll find interviews with many a luminary. Subscribe to the podcast series to be notified when new episodes drop. Also, visit our website, hnsa.org.au, subscribe to our newsletter, and join our Facebook group to be effortlessly up to date with all that's hip and happening in historical fiction. I'm Greg Johnston. It's so good to have your company imagining the past.